So today is the last new lecture of the semester, because next Monday is Alumni Day, where we have, I think, five or six alums coming back to talk about 202 sort of in their jobs. I've asked them to kind of bias their discussion around the 202 issues. We have a course review next Wednesday that will build, of course, on the course review we'll have in your sections on Monday. And then Monday the 14th is the final exam, followed by our traditional 202 tasting in the downstairs lounge. Today we're going to talk about text classification as a rich area of NLP. And I'll briefly mention a number of different areas, including news topic categorization, author identification or author profiling, and spam classification. And I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about sort of probability theory, just to help make sure you understand some of the discussion in that paper about Bayes' theorem and stuff, which is getting progressively more important in thinking about decision making and judgment. Again, I want to make the point that it shouldn't take you 3 hours to do the exam. I could say you could have all day if you want, but again, the point is to make you not feel any time pressure. I think the exam, which we have not yet made up, we're still working on it, will be slightly longer than the midterm, but not like twice as long as the midterm, and so it should be something which is manageable in 3 hours. And for many of you, that will be the end of your semester. I know that some of you have a few other dangling things at the end, but mostly this is a big thing to get out of the way. And that's why we want to celebrate the wine tasting that afternoon. Okay, so let's talk about what classification means. I mean, classification, as you know from earlier in the semester, is using some system of categories. And so we're going to use, in NLP, we're going to use classification techniques to assign some objects to two or more classes or categories. And these might be things like words, say, what part of speech is this? What sense of the word is this? Is it bank as in money or bank as in river? Is this document relevant or not relevant? What's it about? Is it a sports story or a financial story? Is it fun or is it noise? A project that Aaron Knight and Ryan Greenberg did in their NLP class this semester. Is this written by Shakespeare or by somebody else, or is it English or Spanish? You can think of any kind of classification. I specify in advance what the bins we're going to put things into are. And that's a really important thing that we do every day in NLP for all sorts of purposes. So let me start with a simple one. Many of you have used things like Google News, where Google News, if you haven't, you better use it soon because it's about to become paid for service. This morning there was a story in the paper that in response to a lot of pressure from publishers of news, newspapers and so on, Google is going to start limiting the number of news stories you can read for free on a given day in order to encourage people to actually subscribe to news stories, to news sources, which I think is a good thing. So Google News basically takes thousands of English language news sources, actually in other languages as well now, and arranges them and says, what are they about? And puts them in categories. And Google says that it's all done by machine. There are some fixed categories, like we know that we sort by country and by business versus sports and so on, but within those categories, the actual stories themselves are identified. And all the newspapers that are writing about the same story, maybe it is actually the same text if it's syndicated or about the same event, will all show up in a clump. And this is really good to get a sense of how important a story is in the world and which ones you want to read more about. But what's interesting to think about in this context is that, you know, what really is a story? If Google is analyzing the content of the story and some of the metadata like the source and the date and so on to categorize it on the basis of this topic. What if the story has a very different point of view on the same event? Is that really the same story? So, for example, if we have two stories and one of them is titled Police Arrest Student Protesters Ending Illegal Occupation of UC's Wheeler Hall, is that the same story as
students protest, use tuition hikes with symbolic occupation on UC campus. I mean, they're going to have very different points of view. They might even emphasize different facts. I'm sure they will emphasize different quotes and so on. I mean, are they the same story or not? Should they be thought of as the same story? Dan, you're a journalist. Are they the same story?
That's a very difficult question.
That's why I ask you. You're the writer, man. You're the reporter.
It's current. That's currently being very. It's a current, kind of very active topic, especially as news has become more free and more accessible.
So, this is why. Anyone else have an opinion? That's really sort of put the end of the discussion. Yeah, it's a hard problem. We're done. But, yeah, Thomas.
I think it should be treated as part of the same story because it relates to the same event, but it presents different views, different angles.
So you could have levels of abstraction. You have sort of an abstract story, then there's different actual specific stories about that same abstract event, perhaps.
In this case, that wouldn't be too difficult to determine, right. But there might be more complicated.
The journalistic ideal is not to present opinion or weighted terms in the story itself, but in quotation marks you can.
But these are two titles I found on the web.
That would, yeah.
I mean, symbolic occupation is like, this really wasn't illegal. They were just making a symbolic point. Emily.
I was going to say it might depend on how good your NLP algorithm is at identifying the bias, because if it can't distinguish it, then it's going to say.
That's exactly right. So Google makes no attempt to put these into different bins. Okay? But there is actually an interesting paper I saw last year at the CHI conference that said we should make this an NLP application and basically systematically identify different points of view and to ensure that you get covered. So you say, I want to make sure I get both sides of this story. So it'll find the Fox version and the MSNBC story of everything, and then you get to see them both in context. So this is a very interesting idea, and there's a final project just started right here in this school by Michael Manicheri, I think, and some other folks, to build something like this for their master's project. So if you didn't know that, we should follow that thing carefully and see how it plays out. So let's talk a little bit about what classification really means. It essentially assumes some system of categories, and then we train some NLP system to assign new instances to the appropriate category. And this is why it's called supervised learning, because we give it supervision by saying, here are some stories that are in the right bins. Use this as examples to learn the features that are going to help you put things in the right categories. And essentially, this is what you see most usefully in NLP, essentially supervised learning, where you have labeled classes. The contrasting approach is clustering, where you say, we don't assume any categories, we're going to just find categories in which we can maximize the similarity of things within the category, maximize the similarity within categories and minimize it between them. Please strike the word maximize here and change it to minimum. I knew I had a problem. I saw two words in the same sentence that were the same. So I'm going to minimize the similarity between categories, make the bins maximally distinct. Okay? One way to think about this is visually is to say, I've got this pile of things, this red things and green things, and how do I separate them? What feature can I use that will distinguish the objects of class 1 from class 2? In this case, it's pretty, I say, well, if I can think of a feature where I can say, things have a value of the feature of this, greater than this, there was one side and greater, less than this is the other side, I can draw a line between them and get most of it right. Of course, most classification problems are not that simple. There may be multiple features I have to use. And simply, this picture is simply trying to suggest that I need to have more features so I can carve out the little islands that otherwise are surrounded by items with the values on the one feature. So I just want to think of a more complex discrimination function that will let me identify. And this, in fact, gets all of them correct. We have no mistakes. We can completely separate the green ones and the red ones with a more complex discriminating function. So What's the basic process here? The basic process is you specify the class. We say there's red guys and green guys, or there's noise and there's fun, or there's sports or there's business. There's spam or not spam, whatever it is. And we're going to say those are the classes. We have some examples of each of those classes. We're going to then extract features and develop a classifier algorithm which does a good job of basically replicating the classes we've already labeled. So we said we know that this is spam and this is not spam. If we can write a function which then reproduces that result, we can then with confidence use to classify new examples. And we can use all sorts of different features. I mean, to identify membership in these classes, we can use linguistic features like the words that are used in each in the instances, the phrases. We can use things like the frequency of particular letters or pairs of letters. We can use punctuation. We can use all sorts of linguistic features. We could use things like the presence of links or the presence of dates. It turns out that when you're distinguishing fun and noise, most people, when they write about fun, are talking about events that have dates. And so the presence of a date is a good indicator that it's a fun story. Whereas the absence of a date, I guess, is indicated there must be just a noise story. It's something about more general, perhaps. And then we can use also non-linguistic features like the way in which the instances are formatted or the way they're structured. It could be things like even things like the font that they're done in and things like that. I mean, we've seen, of course, forensic kind of work where they find using because of the particular typewriter that the evil person did when they wrote those notes, they can track it back to them. So the actual presence of certain kinds of features of typewriters, like maybe one key was broken. So any message that has that broken key is a good indicator that it was typed on that typewriter, therefore it was done by that evil person and so on. So, I mean, in some sense, we leave it up to the program to figure out what these features are because they'll be different in different contexts. There's no one set of features which is equally good in all contexts, and so you have to do the usual kinds of text processing to eliminate, you know, weight and normalize features. So things like dimensionality reduction are really important here to make the problems more tractable. And we can do this feature selection in a generic or a specific manner. We can try different techniques. And if you take NLP, you'll learn all sorts of different ways to try this stuff. And you'll be classifying your way to fame and fortune. Okay. A really interesting domain of classification is in authorship. There are at least three different use cases. The first one is identification, where we want to ask the question, who wrote this? Did William Shakespeare write this particular play that has suspect authorship? We can examine other things that Shakespeare has written and use that as the training set, and then see what gets the training set right will also predict that Newman was written by Shakespeare. So you might have contested authorship, and you have a couple of candidates, and you wanted to figure out which of the guys or which of the authors wrote the contested piece of work. Sometimes you have so many possible candidates that you really can't say which of these two people wrote this. You may say, well, what can we learn about the background or characterization of the author? Is it a kid, or is it an adult, or is it someone in a Middle Eastern country, or someone in Japan? What can we know about the attributes of the author, even if we can't identify him or her uniquely? And again, we can also do things like similarity detection, like, say, detecting plagiarism. Is the person who wrote this document the same one who wrote this one? But since you know that the other one was written by somebody other than the person it's supposed to be by, maybe you plagiarized. If there's too much similarity between these two pieces of text, then maybe the plagiarism took place. Or perhaps even self-plagiarism, which is also kind of a bad thing. We write the same paper 16 times for 16 very different journals. Everyone does it, but it's kind of looked down upon. Okay. Well, why do we care about this? Well, look, we care a lot about this problem because of... I'm sorry, I'm ahead of myself. Okay. We care a lot about it because of this. Here are four famous people who have been involved in authorship identification cases. Do you know who these people are? All right, I suspect that some of you know who this is probably the most recognizable guy on this page for most of you. And that's Osama bin Laden. Okay? Now, some of you don't know who these people are because they're Americans. But if you don't know who they are, you can look on the $10 bill, if I have one. $10 bill? Don't have a $10 bill. A $10 bill is one of the few people who is not a president who's on our money. And that's Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury. Okay? Another guy is James Madison, who was one of the presidents. And these guys were involved in a very interesting NLP application to determine who wrote the Federalist Papers. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Who's the guy in the upper left? The Unabomber. Who is the Unabomber? You know the Unabomber? Okay. Unabomber is... Who's Ted Kaczynski?
The guy who got a PhD from him and then he kept to himself. He started mailing bombs.
He was a kind of reclusive dude. He got alienated about the role of technology in society and he moved to Montana and started sending bombs to people and blowing up them. People lost their hands and their lives and all kinds of stuff. Why is he important to us here at Berkeley? He went here. He was a professor in the math department here, or a postdoc in the math department, and he lived in Evans Hall over there. That's Kaczynski Hall. They don't say that when they do the tour. This is Kaczynski Hall. They should. That's better than saying that stupid little bear. That's more important. That's the Kaczynski Hall, where Ted Kaczynski learned his evil ways. Okay? Well, have you ever been in the math department? The math department is a weird department. Here's why it's weird. In math, the prevailing view of a math professor is that if you have to be taught, you don't deserve to be taught. You're not smart enough to be a math person, so why should we bother teaching you? They have the worst teaching ratings in the whole university by a whole bunch. Right? They hate to teach, they're terrible teachers, because they think, if you don't learn this yourself, then you're too stupid to do math, so why should we bother talking to you? So imagine what it's like to be a person in that department for like many years, locked in the basement with no windows. You'll start throwing bombs around too. So Ted Kaczynski, okay? Well, that's exaggerating, I guess. But you sometimes feel it if you're locked in the basement for a long time, right? Not everyone goes out the deep end, but Ted certainly went out the deep end. So Ted moves to Montana, sending around these bombs, and he wrote this thing called the Manifesto, the Unabomber Manifesto, which is this long, long diatribe against technology and society. And his brother said, "That sounds like my wacko brother. He writes that kind of stuff." And actually, his brother actually turned him in and said, they gave him other documents and they showed that it really was definitely Kaczynski writing this up, and they figured out where he was and they went and got him. But it was because of his writing style was so distinctive, they were able to figure out who it was. Okay, so the basic idea here, again, is that we have some text with an unknown author and a couple of possible authors, and we say, given their writing that we know about, can we conclude with some certainty who wrote that document that we don't have an author pinned to? And so you want to find what features are relatively constant among all the writings of a particular author. And that's actually more consistent than you might think. People have particular writing styles. And so you have essentially n features, and so you have any writing is going to be an n-dimensional feature vector. And we then can train a classifier to distinguish, use the similarity of a new vector to the ones we know about to figure out if that's the right person. So the paper you had to read about writing, write prints and fingerprints, I think that's kind of a cool title, actually. I don't know why. I just like the idea of a write print. Said, let's look at some of the features we might use to distinguish, to characterize an author's style. And we have, you know, the choice of words or characters, the way that we use punctuation, the way in which you organize your paragraphs, the particular kinds of words you use in a particular domain. Now, everyone knows this. I mean, some people write and they put every other word in quotes. You know those kind of people? Alright? So they're just full of quotation marks. Other people like to use dash dash instead of a comma. Other people like to use semicolons instead of commas. Other people love camel case. Go with camel case. Alright. Okay? So again, those things are going to be indicators of a particular profile. And so you can use this kind of stuff. And if you have some set of suspects, you can say, well, who wrote this particular new document? And so in that paper, there's this wonderful picture here that have Mike, Joe, and Roy as three candidates for writing some particular documents. And it looks to me like this is Mike. So Mike is this particular person, but these two people, they're the same person. It's a person using another alias because the right print is exactly the same across these different features in terms of the proportions of these particular features, the rating on this feature scale, whatever that y-axis is. Yes?
This sounds very similar to how they used to do handwriting analysis to determine the very same thing.
That's why it's fingerprint to right print. It could be fingerprint, you know, handwriting to right print. The whole idea is that what features can we use to uniquely identify some author style? Yes?
Is this what's used to detect plagiarism?
Well, if you look at the exam last year, there was a question about plagiarism, and it really sort of would have helped to have read this paper or things like this paper, because of course you can say, can we profile the style of this thing or the word patterns in this thing, right? I mean, what's the similarity between this document and this document? If it's the exact words, it's pretty easy to know it's the same document. But suppose you have just changed the words to synonyms. Well, we have techniques like LSA that can identify that because they may have the exact same underlying structure, same punctuation, but you just change you know, fish to sea animal. I mean, come on. It's not that difficult to figure out that you've plagiarized. Tony.
So this feels very similar to a lot of the TFIDF discussions that we've had.
Yes.
What I'm wondering is what is it irrelevant in some way? I mean, is there a way that you're actually filtering out some of these features, or do you want to wait them out?
Well, we're going to get that in a minute. But first of all, I want to apologize to the math department at the University of California, Berkeley. I realized I was over the line there a few minutes ago. I mean, it's not a cause of going crazy being in the math department. It may be correlated, but it's not a cause. So. But living in rooms with no windows in the dark all the time is definitely going to set you off. I suppose there's a lot of suicide in Scandinavia in the wintertime. It really is. They lead the world in suicides in the winter because it's so dark and cold and damp. Okay, so the question Tony asked is, are all features equally important? The answer is no. We do dimensionality reduction the same way. We can say, let's find, using our algorithm, let's find the best set of classifiers, the optimal subset of all the features. And we see that when we have a smaller number, we get better results. Because if features are correlated, that means they can be noisy. So you want to extract the ones which are not the best predictors that are correlated with the ones that are the better predictors. Okay?
I was thinking that maybe this kind of classification could be used on Craigslist or on eBay to find out whether there's people who are posting like noise just to, I mean, if you're trying to sell a car, you also post other postings of this very same car with different prices and just to inflate the price.
That's a great idea. I bet you there are people doing that stuff on eBay, and I bet you eBay's fighting back with that kind of way. Anyway, they should do that. Anyone know about that?
If you try to post pretty much the same ad in two different categories in Craigslist, they notify you.
Really?
They should do that. No.
Does anyone know the guys at Craigslist? It's worth asking that question. It's a good idea. Yeah.
That would be a Jim. Interesting question. I can ask
it. Ask him. It's an interesting question about whether they use NLP techniques to do things like detect.
Because if you repost the same thing too quickly, a week, your ad expires, and then you want to just repost it the day it expires, they won't let you do that either.
There must be like a fingerprint or something about the ad. That makes sense. Kate.
Just Craigslist really does rely on people reporting. They use a lot of...
So they crowdsource this.
Yeah.
Okay.
When I was looking for an apartment, I had so many apartment listings.
Ah.
But before you can even get there, you try to post it.
Yeah, but they use multiple layers.
Well, these are great exam questions. I'm sorry we're burning them all up in class. This would have been a great question, because you never would have, I haven't talked about Craigslist, we could have used that in an exam, would have been perfect. So you see, that's a good idea, that's what, yeah.
I think it seems like there's something really dangerous about depending on this, especially in the criminal justice system. Just because, I mean, yeah, I get that you can, you know, tell an author by the way that they write, but a lot of people are, you know, sometimes taught by the same people, taught the same writing guidelines. Some people have no writing style, in which case it's very pointed, it's very straightforward, and it might match up to a ton of other people who write the same way.
Well, I wouldn't send it to the electric chair on the basis of your vector. There should be other evidence that corroborates
what you're doing. But I mean, you know what I mean? If there's too much dependence on it, it could... I don't know. There just seems like there's something dirty about it. I don't know.
Well, you could, as opposed to say tampered evidence by a corrupt prosecutor.
That's bad too. I'm not saying.
I mean, do you watch CSI, for example? They use a lot of high technology stuff, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly how the justice system
works. Isn't it? Isn't it? Lee.
But this is still probabilistic. It doesn't actually close the loop.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to send you to prison for the rest of your life because we did a vector on you. Okay? I mean, there should be other evidence that kind of corroborates. Okay? And I suspect that you could go into the courtroom and say, well, his vector says, and the jury would say, what's a vector? You'd be off. Alright? So, I mean, maybe, you're right, but I mean, it certainly is giving us a strong suspicion. And that's useful to winnow the set of possible bad guys into a smaller set. Let's do a better one that makes you feel like it's not such a bad thing, okay? Yeah.
Question about the relationship between the size of the document or the amount of text to do an active analysis with. I mean, you think that two sentences on Craigslist probably...
Yeah, you need more data, I think. I mean, that's a question for the NLP people. Does anyone know what... Yo Shang or Aaron or someone who's taken the NLP class, you want to make a comment about the size of the instances you need to do an accurate classification? You did noise and fun, so you had a typical message was what, a couple hundred characters, a couple hundred words? Kind of makes sense. If you learn a lot, then you can use a lot. If you don't have much to learn on, then you haven't got much to go on. Let's do one that's basically better. Not bad guys, but good guys. So, the Federalist Papers. This is a really important part of United States history. The Constitution had been written, but they were trying to get states to ratify it. And there were a number of sort of like op-ed pieces, we'd call them today, written to try to convince the state of New York to ratify the Constitution. And there are a set of some of these which, they're written by Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison in the late 1780s. And there are some of them which have disputed authorship. So, classic paper in NLP, which sort of started a whole lot of this work, was done in 1964 by a couple of statisticians, Mostow and Wallace. And they basically looked at the words that were best at discriminating among the authors of the papers that we knew the authorship of. And they found that Madison was the one who wrote the disputed papers. Okay? So here you see this three dimensions here. We're just showing the words upon, to, and would. Were these three words which happen to have different distributions in the Federalist Papers. Because it makes sense. They're writing about the same things, but they have different grammatical styles. So some of them have more complex sentence structures and things like that. And so here you see that Hamilton's up in this part of the region, and Madison's down in this part of the region, and the green papers are the ones which we had disputed authorship of, and they're clearly Madison's. So this was a way to demonstrate statistically that Madison should get credit for the 12 papers. You feel better now, Jess? Okay. And we didn't send Madison to jail, and neither did we send Hamilton. But Hamilton died in a duel a few years later. He got shot by Aaron Burr, so he died. You know, he would have been a president, but he died because he was shot in a duel. You know that, right? This is amazing. We actually had duels. And, you know, the old kind of style thing. And Alexander Hamilton was killed in a duel by Aaron Burr, who was the vice president at the time or something like that, which is an astonishing thing. Imagine a vice president having a duel and killing the Secretary of Treasury or something like that. Is that amazing? Cheney shooting, you know? Hillary Clinton getting shot by Robert Gates. I mean, think about that, right? Is that amazing? Joe Biden shooting Hillary Clinton. Yeah. Oh, Cheney shot some other guy when he was hunting, that's right. But it wasn't over a duel, it was an accident. I mean, but think about that. Imagine, you know, Joe Biden shooting Hillary Clinton. That's what this is about. I mean, it's that kind of historical anomaly, right? That Alexander Hamilton got killed in a duel. Wow.
Looks a lot like 24.
All right, good. Okay. All right. You know, I think the semester's almost out. We can tell, can't we? We're all sort of unraveling at the end here. But it's more fun when we're unraveling, you know? It's like I'm ad-libbing more, I'm more comfortable, like making up bad things about math departments and rules and stuff. Alright. So, sometimes there's too many people who are possible candidates for office, so you want to just do a better job of characterizing them. For example, we're saying, gee, we don't know where these males come from. Are they coming from someone in a Middle Eastern country? That would be useful to know right now. Or, gee, we're a company that sells products, and we kind of want to know what kind of people are posting all these bad messages on bulletin boards about our products. Who are they? Are they kids? Are they adults? Are they people in retirement homes? Who is talking trash about our products? That'd be useful for a company to know. And so we want to use, NLP techniques to essentially try to identify characteristics that are likely to be held by the people writing these particular messages. So, think about this. We can say, what features, what would tell us about who you are? Now, this is, again, it's sort of obvious if you think about it. So, is a young person or old person likely to say, well, look at this. Here you see style features and content features. You know, haha, LOL. Who's going to say, is that your grandmother going to say LOL in a message? Probably not. Okay? And so here you see some particular style features or content features that might be indicators of gender or age or nationality or personality traits. Okay? Get the idea? So again, we can use this kind of thing to say, where is this writer likely to be from? That might help us if we are in a forensic case, or it might help us if we're in a marketing case. Who should we be targeting with our new promotions? You know, give everyone under 21 some chance to go to a website and get some coupon that gives you a break on the next product that they've been talking trash about, or something like that. You can target your service recovery or product recovery results. So this kind of thing is important. And it brings us to the next topic, which is sentiment analysis, which is one of my favorite topics. Sentiment analysis is sometimes called opinion mining. You think of this kind of a three-stage classification where we're saying, let's find what people think about some particular company or person or product or some other kind of named entity. Let's find out whether the text that's around that named entity is an opinion or a fact, and then try to classify it according to its polarity. That is it a positive versus negative sentiment? And of course, this is hard because these are not really clear boundaries. They're sort of continuing. And we have things like sarcasm and slang and cliches and cultural norms which really obscure the content. So we say, are you really happy today in school today to be in my class? And Ayush goes, yeah, sure. I mean, the words are very positive, but he's not positive when he says it that way. Okay? Or if I said, man, that was a, what do you think of this motorcycle? That's a bad looking motorcycle. Well, is that a good motorcycle or a bad motorcycle? Okay? So there's sort of the convention of using bad in that context to mean good. So again, it's complicated, and you have to have a lot of data to know what people are really meaning and use that then to classify stuff. This is becoming really, really hot in Twitter, it turns out. Because Twitter is, you can think of it as, it's a real-time sentiment you're expressing, right? You want to basically publish this in a burst, and that's what you think of that moment in time. So, if I have a tweet that says, nice job, Delta, you only lost one of my bags this time. I mean, is that a positive statement about Delta Airlines or a negative statement about Delta Airlines? Okay? And sure enough, over the weekend, I went to Twitter Sentiment, which is a new website. Let me see if I can find it here. This is a really interesting place. It's called Twitter. Twitter Sentiment. Okay, here's Twitter Sentiment. Okay? So, who has a cover that they're interested in? What?
Tiger Woods.
Tiger. This is a great one. Oh, Tiger's in trouble. Okay, so this is the sentiment analysis about tweets about Tiger. Positive ones are in green, and negative ones are in red. And the sentiment right now about Tiger is overwhelmingly negative. Okay? Okay? We see now, the Tiger Woods drives very well on the fairway, but doesn't fare well very well on the driver. That's very clever, actually. I like that one, right? Okay? Will Cars for Kids get Tiger Woods' crashed car? Why is Tiger Woods apologizing publicly? He cheated on old girl, not us. OL girl? OL? Is that an abbreviation? I don't know. Alright, anyway, so here you see, this happened like, this is 20 seconds ago, 23 seconds ago, 25, so they're